Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, protests in Bulgaria, how Gen Z toppled a government. The Danish model, a close-up look at the hardline asylum policies setting the tone for the European immigration debate. Plus, an investigation into the Dutch housing crisis. What's causing it and what are the political consequences?
We're 18 million people, and together the Dutch homeowning population owns 1.35 trillion euros in housing wealth, and this housing wealth is almost untaxed.
That's all coming up here on Inside Europe. Now, here's a question for you. Which European government fell last week? The answer is Bulgaria. On December 11th, Prime Minister Rozan Zeliatskov announced the resignation of his cabinet less than a year after taking office. Why? Well, one answer is that Gen Z didn't really give him much of a choice. DW Europe's Lavinia Pitu has been portraiting two of the young people behind the anti-corruption demonstrations that toppled a government, incidentally just weeks before Bulgaria is scheduled to join the Eurozone on January 1st.
Hundreds of thousands of Bulgarians have taken to the streets over the past weeks, rallying against the government and its perceived failure to curb corruption. On December 11th, Prime Minister Rozan Zeliatskov announced the resignation of his cabinet less than a year after taking office. For the first time, the main driving force behind the protests were young people from Generation Z, among them 26-year-old Ivailo Majarov and Arsen Lazarov.
We're fed up with corruption. We're fed up with arrogance.
My generation, Gen Z, brought the need for change in Bulgaria to the forefront.
Ivailo and Asen are the founders of Active Politics, an online platform that breaks down complex political topics into simple, accessible language for young Bulgarians. They launched the project in 2021 in their spare time.
The problem isn't that young people are apolitical. The problem is that political information isn't explained to them.
My generation needed information presented clearly and visually, with graphics and with color.
Their posts on Instagram and TikTok explain topics such as Bulgaria's 2026 budget or the record-fast 32nd vote on a law giving the state control over the Russian Lukoil refinery.
We used metaphors like, in 30 seconds, you can barely put your socks on.
After one of these posts, dozens of young people urged others to step out of the network and into the streets.
Our post, Operation Gen Z, reached more than 350,000 people on Instagram. It included several points. First, we drafted a statement with clear demands regarding the 2026 budget and sent it to the governing majority.
Working with volunteers, they designed protest posters for anyone to print and bring to the square.
Online, we can gather, communicate, criticize the government, but going out into the streets is one of the strongest ways to show you care.
A month ago, the organization had 8,000 Instagram followers. Today, it has more than 30,000. Ahead of the largest protest on December 10th, Ivailo and Asen spent an entire day mobilizing other young people, both in Bulgaria and across the diaspora. For Ivailo and Asen, this protest wave is also personal, a continuation of the fight their parents joined during the 2013 demonstrations against some of the same political figures. Delian Peevski, sanctioned by the US and the UK for corruption, and former Prime Minister Boyko Borisov, who's been facing numerous controversies centered around corruption and abuse of power.
I didn't understand the processes well back then, But even then, I felt the need for things to be explained.
I was at the protests with my father. He told me we have to keep fighting, and I believe we will keep fighting until we get the results we want.
Being civically active is cool, and it's not hard. With united efforts, we will change Bulgaria.
Under Bulgaria's constitution, President Roman Radev will ask parliament to form a new government. If that fails, he will appoint an interim administration until new elections are held. Whether the government's resignation will bring real political stability remains uncertain. After years marked by deep public distrust, corruption scandals and repeated snap elections.
Lavinia Pitu with that report, which is also available as a video. We will be linking to that in the show notes. Now, though, to Denmark. Under the leadership of the Social Democrat Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen, the Nordic country combines a large welfare state with some of Europe's toughest migration and asylum policies. And it's a model which is being looked to for emulation by various other countries, the UK most prominent amongst them. It is, for example, no coincidence that ahead of the Council of Europe meeting the other week, which resulted in a decision to re-examine the framework interpretation of the European Convention on Human Rights, it was Mette Frederiksen and UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer who published an open letter urging their European counterparts to follow their lead in controlling our borders to protect their democracies, as they put it, from the electoral threat posed by the far right. High time then that we took a closer look at the Danish model. From Copenhagen, reporter Adrienne Murray sent us this report.
Inside a bustling kitchen, regulars are chatting and making cups of tea as I visit the Network House, a centre helping refugees settle into a new life in Denmark.
Our main activity is language training and language support.
Showing me around is Kjeld Tornquist, a volunteer and board member.
We have had quite many from Ukraine because of the war. 5-10 years ago, quite many from Syria and obviously also from Afghanistan.
Among them is Malik, who left war-torn Syria a decade ago.
Yeah, I come to Denmark in 2014.
And to speak more freely, he declined to share his full name. Malik's first 10 months were spent at an asylum reception centre before permission was granted to stay for an initial 5 years. Life in Denmark has been okay, he says, but his wife arrived a year ago and she remains in a Danish reception camp. Even though Malik is working and paying his taxes, she's not been allowed to join him. It's much tougher here than surrounding countries like Germany, he tells me. Today, Malik's refugee status remains temporary, and permits must be renewed every year or two. And like other refugees, he's locked in a constant cycle of applications and waiting times. You have no idea whether you can stay or you'll be sent back home. It's a very stressful situation, he says. It's a raft of strict immigration rules like these that have now driven asylum claims down to a 40-year low. And at the heart of Denmark's approach is deterrence, says author and researcher Michelle Pace.
The recurring theme here is a harsh rhetoric, a deterrent rhetoric, a very clear message to anyone considering Denmark to be their country of safety to seek asylum in. You are simply not welcome here, particularly if you come from certain parts of the Middle East and North Africa.
In a small country of 6 million people, the government has argued that strict limits on immigration help preserve Danish values and protect its lauded welfare state. Denmark's immigration minister is Rasmus Stocklund.
We, quite a long time ago, realized that we wouldn't be able to maintain a high degree of social cohesion and trust in our society if we accepted a migration from countries where there was too many people who ended up being unemployed and being criminal. And that was why we strengthened our regulation in a broad number of ways, which means that it's today is relatively difficult to get access to live in Denmark. for that reason, we are able to hold the numbers down. Family reunification is more difficult. You need to provide for yourself. Welfare benefits are low and so on.
Many of Denmark's tough policies were born a decade ago, supercharged by Europe's refugee crisis and the growing popularity of a far-right anti-immigration party. Copenhagen introduced a succession of tighter rules. To win back working-class voters, Mette Frederiksen's left-wing Social Democrats also doubled down on immigration, sealing a 2019 election victory and gutting support for the far right. Peter Nellegaard is a professor of political science at Copenhagen University.
That was a totally shift from everything that has been before. It was a restrictive immigration policy for people seeking asylum on the one hand. It was also a more tough policy of integration for people already living here.
In central Copenhagen, the Mjolnirparken neighborhood has been undergoing a transformation. This estate has seen major redevelopment and is barely recognizable from when I visited only a few years ago. The buildings have had a facelift, new coffee shops and bars have appeared, but many original tenants have had to move out and new residents have moved in. That's because Mjolnirparken has been subject to parallel society rules. In areas where more than half of residents are deemed non-Western, previously labelled ghettos, homes have been sold off or demolished to change the demographic makeup. However, the controversial practice has also faced legal pushback. Denmark's policies may be tough, says Nellegaard, but they're effective.
It has actually been a success. People now living more widely spread, people living among each other to a degree that has not been the case without these ghetto laws. Integration has failed in very many European countries. People are not getting into the labour market if they come as refugees. But in Denmark, to a large extent, they are.
For Michaela Bendiksen from advisory group Refugees Welcome, the often negative public perceptions don't match the reality.
The whole game is actually about the Danish voters. It's not about the refugees. A recent survey showed this so clearly. A university asked a number of native Danish, what do you think about integration of non-Western immigrants in Denmark? How do you think it's going? And it turned out that the Danes, they guessed totally wrong. They thought things were so much worse than they actually are.
Locals in Copenhagen shared their thoughts on the issue.
I see it as very strict, maybe a little bit too strict, a little bit inhuman.
I think that they have tightened it up a lot, and I think that's a good thing. But I don't like the tone of it. I think it's creating a lot of hostility.
I really hope that we will change to go in a lighter way and see immigrants as human beings instead of just a number in the line.
After a disastrous local election for the Social Democrats last month, there are signs of trouble for Frederiksen. Right now, her party has slumped in the polls to around 17%. With rivals both to the right and further to the left gaining ground. Outside Parliament, I spoke to political commentator Noah Reddington. With the general election next year, immigration is again becoming a key battleground.
No doubt it's going to be crucial, going to be in top three when it comes to issues. Also, Mette Frederiksen's been in government for like 6 years, so she's vulnerable. And we can see that the Danish People's Party, which is like the most right-wing party on immigration, is going to even further right. So there is going to be a gap between what the Social Democrats are saying and what the right-wing are going to say in the upcoming election. This can be crucial.
Denmark is now urging other nations to follow its tough lead and arguing for an overhaul of European immigration policy. Meanwhile, other countries, like the UK, are already taking inspiration. Adrienne Murray, DW, reporting from Copenhagen.
As we were going to studio, an ECJ ruling was just coming in with Europe's top court deciding that there may be a risk that what was formerly called the Danish ghetto legislation is directly discriminatory, and therefore the Eastern High Court should investigate whether or not this is the case. In other words, not particularly conclusive.
Thank you.
Yes, I know the news is unrelenting, but allow me one quick concession to Christmas. If you head on over to Spotify, you will see that our quiz question is challenging you to identify the country where you might find a Christmas witch. Is it A, France, B, Italy, C, Spain, or D, Romania? According to legend, the three wise men, or magi, asked the witch for directions on their way to visit baby Jesus. They invited her to come with them, but she was too busy cleaning her house and declined. Later, she regretted her decision and set out to find the baby, handing out gifts to children on the way in the hope that one of them will eventually be the one she seeks. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
It's tough being German. People think I'm punctual, but I'm often late. Let's do a quick check of stereotypes. When you think of Germany, you think of
extreme punctuality,
perfect planning,
high-tech and efficiency.
Well, think again.
Welcome to Delayland,
a podcast about a country that needs your help.
Available wherever you get your podcasts.
The Netherlands, you may remember, had an election this year. Another one, called after the previous government fell apart after anti-immigrant politician Geert Wilders pulled his party from the coalition over a row about, yeah, you guessed it, immigration. Whilst immigration and asylum did remain big topics for voters, the number one issue at the ballot box, however, seemed to be housing. So, with coalition talks ongoing, we tasked Amsterdam-based reporter Fernand van Tetz with digging a little deeper into the Dutch housing issue for us.
Calvin den Dekker is 19 years old and has a full-time job at Schiphol Airport. He currently lives with his parents in Almere, a city east of Amsterdam. He's tried to find a rental property there for a year without any success.
I have recently started looking at finding a place to live in another way, so by renting a room, because I know that an apartment will just be very difficult to get.
Tonight, he'll go look at a room in Amsterdam, but it will be temporary, just from January till May. He isn't alone in his predicament.
Many of my friends who still live at home are trying to get social housing through a cooperative, but I have realized that it will take 10 years until it will be my turn.
The Netherlands has a shortage of about 400,000 homes, and housing was one of the hot-button issues of the elections at the end of October.
Everywhere I go in the Netherlands, I hear the same. Teachers and nurses who can't live where they work. Young people, families and seniors who delay life choices. We need a breakthrough fast. And D66 wants to build 10 new cities for all the homes we need in the coming years.
Rob Jetter, who promised to tackle the housing crisis, is poised to become the next prime minister. But the problems are many. Cody Hoogstenbach is an associate professor in urban geography at the University of Amsterdam.
But we also especially have a shortage in affordable rental housing, and this is the outcome of government policies.
That policy has seen the amount of social housing shrink.
So the Netherlands still has the largest social rental sector in Europe, 28%, but this used to be around 40% in the late 1980s.
Instead, the government has heavily favoured private home ownership. Almost 60% of people in the Netherlands now live in their own home, contributing to rising house prices and leaving everyone else stuck in a rental market in which demand far outstrips supply.
At the moment, we heavily subsidise home ownership through mortgage interest tax deductions, through barely taxing the value of your property. And on the other hand, we punish rental, so to say. So there's a very uneven playing field.
The mortgage tax deduction is set to be phased out by the two parties that are hoping to form a government, the Liberal D66 and the Christian Democrats. They've also pledged to make it easier to build and aim to construct 100,000 homes a year. But it will take more than just building homes to solve the housing crisis, says Hoogstenbach.
You could argue maybe you should not just build more housing, but also try to look at what's already there, the existing housing stock, and try to allocate housing more efficiently, get a better distribution of people across the existing housing stock.
The best way to do that, he says, is tax home ownership.
The Dutch population, we're 18 million people, and together the Dutch homeowning population owns 1.35 trillion euros in housing wealth, and this housing wealth is almost untaxed. But if we would start to proportionally tax housing wealth, this would be one of the incentives for people to start living smaller, for example. This would be one of the incentives for people to live in housing that is more suitable to their needs.
Another option is to change how we build homes. That is the solution proposed by De Varre, a new housing cooperative in Amsterdam. I'm standing outside a building that looks a bit like a castle. The huge windows have posters advertising a cinema event and an upcoming rave, as well as a naked drawing class. Kim Otte, one of the founders, is taking me on a tour.
We have 36 housing units here, spread out across 5 floors. We're walking up to the first floor now, and every floor has a diversity of homes. So there are rooms, studios, and family homes, which are various sizes, and therefore you can grow within the building.
One third of the building is communal space, including communal kitchens, a huge lobby, garden, and even a roof terrace with a sauna.
And that's what's mooie van zoveel ruimtes delen. We noemen het.
That's the beauty in sharing so much space. We call it communal luxury because you have access to so much, but you share it because you don't always need it. It makes you feel like you live in a big castle with so many different spaces and possibilities.
This project was started by a group of friends and received a subsidy from the municipality of Amsterdam in 2017. The cooperative then designed, funded, and developed the building themselves.
As soon as you sign a rental contract, you become a member of our association and are a part owner of the building. When you leave, that disappears. So the building will always be owned by the tenants.
Otten says this form of living is a way to break the gridlock in the Dutch housing market.
It's between buying and renting. When you buy a property, you have a say in what your living environment looks like. When you rent, in principle, you don't. But we do. As residents, we designed it ourselves and also manage it ourselves.
Financially, too, it's a middle way. The cooperative has rental prices that are 10 to 20% below current market rates. And the paid rent is seen as a loan to the association. Once the construction loans to the bank have been paid off, tenants will receive part of the rent they have paid back.
That also brings some financial fairness and decreases the difference between buying and renting. Because with renting, you throw away your money and never see it again. And buying is an investment. This way, also people who have less money can get some financial compensation. That is what makes it so groundbreaking.
When the new government is finally in place, housing will be top of its intray. Might they look to solutions like this? Fernand van Tetz, DW, Amsterdam.
Housing utopias. Another world is possible. But is it the one we'll be getting? Either way, you'll hear all about it here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock in Germany.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Now, listen up, all you hungry real estate bargain hunters out there, because there is a 20-bedroom castle complete with servants' quarters and rich historic contents on a beautiful, remote Scottish island, and it could all be yours for the price of a decent family home in a nice part of London, just £750,000 or €850,000. There are, of course, a few catches, not least of which is the millions you would need in order to restore it. So, what sort of private buyer is being sought, and is it all really worth saving? Richard Baines travelled to the incidentally, genuinely, stunningly beautiful island of Rum to visit Kinloch Castle and find out more.
We're coming in the back door of Kinloch Castle now, because the front door, we can't get in because there's a ceiling collapsed.
So there's already a wee bit of a smell.
Islander L. Hutchinson is my guide.
Yeah. It's been a wee while since any air fresheners or anything were in here.
The place was built at the end of the 19th century by Sir George Buller. His family had made a huge fortune from the UK cotton industry. They bought the 10,000-hectare island, which lies 25 kilometres off the mainland, and turned it into a playground for themselves and their friends.
This gong is just in one of the main corridors into the place, and it just would have been used to call people down to dinner.
We headed into the lavish accommodation once enjoyed by Sir George and his wife, Lady Monica. The castle is for sale with its spectacular contents.
This is the dining room. There's a big oak table in the middle. It's surrounded by these gorgeous paintings of Rum. It's got a very nice view onto the bay. This is the great hall, and the walls lined with deer heads.
Some fantastic things here, like a very mangy-looking lion skin.
Here, it actually doesn't have any eyeballs, which is a wee bit disconcerting, but also quite terrifying still. On top of this piano, it's a very gorgeous, impressive piano. It's massive. There's kind of some scratch marks on the top, and apparently it's where a lady jumped up on the piano with her high heels. Little dance during one of their parties. So we're looking at an area just now where it's looking a wee bit worse for wear than the great hall that we were just in there. The ceiling's kind of been propped up by these two steel beams, and it's just because this is where a bit of dry rot is set in. This large room here was the ballroom. It's a very grand room.
There's a sprung floor. You can feel that, can't
you? Perfect for dancing. And you can see that the windows are actually really high up. And that's essentially because they didn't want the servants to see what was going on in here. So it was just kept very, very private.
It makes you wonder what was going on in here,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, or you almost don't want to know.
Upstairs, there are what were once luxurious bedrooms and some interesting art.
There's a lovely big picture here, and it's of Lady Monica in the nude, drinking a cup of tea.
On a furry rug, yeah.
And it's just sitting pride of place in the hallway where people are going to bed.
The castle is Category A listed, the highest level of protection for a historic building in Scotland. Agents handling the sale say it would cost at least £10 million to restore it, although the dry rot has already been treated. But it might not be quite what it appears.
We're in Lady Monica's bedroom just now, and we've kind of got a really good example just up on the roof there about how this building was built. What you're looking at there is kind of this rusted kind of steel beam clad in sandstone, and it's kind of the same way as, you know, cotton mills would have been built. You know, this place is built by the same people, so it's not your kind of authentic castle. It's essentially a cotton mill with turrets.
The castle dominates the view up the sheltered Loch Scresset, sitting on one of the island's few flat areas and ringed by wild rocky hills. Rum is a nature reserve and renowned for red deer, rare waterfowl, peace and a sense of isolation. There are just 40 or so people living on the island. So why is the castle up for sale now? Well, the Bullers sold Rum, including the castle, to Scotland's Nature Conservation Agency in 1957. The agency, now known as Nature Scot, ran the place as visitor accommodation for a while, but that ended 10 years ago. Chris Donald is from Nature Scot.
Our business isn't to run a hotel or a hostel or anything like that. Our business is nature. This is an asset that we have that is far better off being managed by people who know how to look after buildings and know how to run businesses, etc.
The building and its 7 hectares of grounds cost around £64,000 a year just to maintain, even in its present state. With no other government agency to take it on, and after private deals failed to dispose of it, it's now on the open market.
What we're looking for is somebody who has the means, a commitment to restoring it. The key element for us is that it's an asset that is used and that it brings benefit to the island and the community. So yeah, we need somebody who is committed. The expectation is they will bring the skills and the expertise in to restore the building.
It could become a luxury hotel, providing dozens of jobs. Islander Stuart McKee runs the local shop.
Anyone who's willing to invest in it, anyone who's willing to put the time and the money and the effort into it, I would welcome it. This island, along with, you know, a lot of places up and down the West Coast, are crying out for investment, more businesses and more people. It's the only way we can provide more jobs, build more homes, a secure future. So, yeah, anything that brings more people and more jobs to the island is a good thing for me.
But there are those who question the sale and restoration.
Just outside the house is a grassy area on the shore, so it's like a salt marsh. So there's like a few halophytic plants grow here, really salt tolerant.
Islander Fliss Fraser runs her own accommodation for visitors.
I'm not sure that a private sale, how that will work. Everybody knows that the person who's got the most money has got the most power. That person who owned the castle estate would clearly have to have hundreds of millions of pounds at their disposal to buy the place and do anything with it. We've seen in other places, they can buy up any available properties that have come on the market. And obviously with more staff working for the castle and becoming part of the community, but maybe not wanting to speak against their employer, that could create a power imbalance.
So could it just be left to a kind of managed decline?
There's more positive terms like adaptive release. So trying to create something positive out of an old building which it isn't economically viable to restore. Letting a building age and decay slowly in a managed, safe way.
In time it becomes a ruin?
In time part of it could become a ruin. There are people on the island that would think it'd be better off just knocking it down. But also people have an expectation of public access. I mean, I don't know if people would still be so happy for it to be sold privately if there were no public access.
But a survey by NatureScot found most islanders want the place sold and restored. And the agency says the government gives it no choice.
Policy and guidance from Historic Environment Scotland is leading us to a position that actually managed decline and demolition is not an option. We have to realise this as an asset.
Since it went on sale, there's been a steady stream of viewings by potential buyers, but so far, no deal has been struck. Richard Baines, 4DW, on the island of Rum, Scotland.
Just across the water from Rum on the Isle of Skye, there is a fantastic little campsite, highly recommended for those of you who prefer canvas to castles. Not sure about the Wi-Fi connection, though. For that, I would recommend the Lithuanian capital Vilnius, soon to be home to Europe's biggest startup campus. Lithuania has also been leading the EU fintech chart for a number of years. Fintech, by the way, is short for financial technology and not Finland, in case you were confused. However, as DW's Lisa Louis reports, there are still hurdles to overcome.
A construction site in southern Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. Dozens of workers are bustling about. A truck is mixing cement. This is set to become part of Europe's biggest startup hub by the end of 2028. The 55,000 square metres of office area in the future incubator will host up to 5,000 workers. Daria Zakaitis, co-founder of Tech City, tells me, as I'm following him up the stairs of one building under construction, this used to be a sewing factory.
Office with high ceilings, like we have here, is very important because it's a cathedral effect. It's proven by science that it's boosting your creativity. Airport is nearby, train station is nearby, and it's very convenient. It's in the middle of the city.
Zakaitis and his business partners are investing 100 million euros in Tech City, which they think could one day be a driver for Lithuania's economic growth.
We do not have natural resources. We do not have a lot of people. Yeah, so we need to be very, very good in something. And I think in building a startups, we are very good because we know how to work hard. A lot of people talk English. In 2030, we will manage to achieve 25% of our GDP from the startup sector.
Wow, that's very ambitious.
Very ambitious, very ambitious. Now it's at 5%.
Lithuania makes up for less than 1% of the EU's GDP and the EU's population. But Lithuania has made it to the top of at least one chart.
The country has turned into Europe's place to be for fintechs. Lithuania holds the EU's record when it comes to the number of fintech licenses. They were totaling about 280 in 2024 and counting.
Fintechs are companies using technology to provide financial services and goods. Examples are electronic payments platforms or lending solutions for small companies. Lithuania's fintech success story started a decade ago after the country streamlined its regulations. They created a financial gateway for non-banks to be directly connected to the central bank and a special fintech license with a minimum capital requirement of 1 million instead of 5 million euros. Rocket in central Vilnius is one of the country's main incubators and the place to be for fintechs. It's where I meet Martina Stankevičius, the founder of Röntgen, a crowdfunding platform which allows citizens to invest in real estate without having to buy whole buildings. Röntgen was one of Lithuania's first fintechs in 2017 and now has an annual turnover of 2 million euros and 17 employees. Stankevičius tells me the country's forties are its clear framework and small size.
We can access direct conversations with the Bank of Lithuania or ministries and have a good relation with them. So it allows a lot faster innovation and problem solving.
After an initial fintech push, though, Lithuania tightened the rules 3 years ago to prevent money laundering.
So we love the ecosystem and the proximity.
That didn't discourage Indra Dagita. She opened her startup Bemibond, another crowdfunding platform, last year. For her, Lithuania's fintech sector has a lead that'll be hard to catch up with, as existing fintechs provide a proper support system for newcomers.
You need a lot of advice in terms of establishing your businesses from the outset. And these companies, they've gone through these rounds, they've gone through these sort of activities and experiences that you're going through. So it's very useful to get this advice.
But investment volume remains a sore spot for Lithuania's startup sector. The country's young tech companies raised only 128 million euros last year, a 73% drop compared to 2021. And there are only three unicorns here, that is, startups valued at over $1 billion. Gintarė Verbikaitė, CEO of Industry Association Unicorns Lithuania, says the government should thus provide more funding, especially for certain areas.
Deep tech is, of course, you know, the sector that needs patient capital. The government role is very important to support investments in the sector. We have also this announced 40 million fund for defense companies and dual use developments. But still, I think, you know, we could definitely raise that, you know, triple at least.
So that one day, Lithuania can indeed reach the startup sky. Lisa Lui, DW, Vilnius.
Time now to shift our focus to the Czech capital, Prague. There, a grisly but compelling dig is underway. Archaeologists are exhuming the bodies of political prisoners executed by Czechoslovakia's communist regime. Activists hope the exhumations are the first step towards unravelling the fate of those whose final resting place remains unknown, including possibly the Czechoslovak parachutists who assassinated senior Nazi Reinhard Heydrich in 1942. From Prague, Rob Cameron reports.
In the sprawling Diablice Cemetery in the northern suburbs of Prague, a pair of archaeologists kneel in the dirt, submerged in a square hole around a metre deep. Working in silence, they brush away soil from fragments of wood as a gentle drizzle patters on the white plastic tent erected over their heads and a chill breeze blows through the trees.
This place is being seen as sacred for political prisoners.
Jiří Línek is head of an organisation called the Association of Former Political Prisoners, 1948 to 1989. He's made it his life's work to bring clarity to this mournful chapter in Czech history. Now, for the first time since 1989, the state is overseeing the exhumation of graves believed to contain the remains of political prisoners.
We are looking for remains of three officers, two of them fighting Germans in France and in England, and one of them in the underground here in the Czech Republic. These mass graves are with the remains of the people from different hospitals in Prague. And between these remains, they were put in, I may say, Czech heroes, which were sentenced to death and later on hanged. And the families shouldn't know where they are.
The three officers, Karel Sabela, Vilém Soksíger, and Miloslav Jebavý, were decorated war heroes, men who had fought the Nazis in France, North Africa, and at home in Czechoslovakia. When the communists took power in February 1948, the officers began planning a military coup aimed at overthrowing the nascent Stalinist regime. But the operation was infiltrated by the secret police. They and several co-conspirators were arrested, tried, and executed. Petr Blažek, a historian specializing in the communist period, says now is the time to rehabilitate them.
To právo na důstojný pohřeb by měli mít všichni lidé.
Every person should have the right to a dignified burial. And for victims of totalitarian regimes who are not allowed that right, it is absolutely justified. It's also the duty of the state to honor people who resisted totalitarianism and to show through their stories what that regime was really like.
Taky se snažil i prostřednictvím jejich příběhů vlastně jako ukázat, co to bylo za režim, no.
Historians still debate how real the coup plan was and how much was fabricated or manipulated by the regime to purge dissent. Some sources suggest the secret police, the STB, may have provoked or exaggerated the plot to justify the arrests.
These people were victims of murder, victims of a crime. It's absurd that some of them are buried here together with people who were murderers or executed as collaborators after the war.
There is, of course, a strong human element. Present at the first day of the exhumations were several descendants of the army officers. They have provided DNA samples to be compared to the corpses of the three men once the correct bodies have been identified and removed from the mass grave. If the match is complete, they will finally be reburied alongside their loved ones. It's a meticulous task that requires great dignity and care, says Martin Čechura, an archaeologist from the Museum of Prague working on the project.
We know that each coffin can contain the remains of several people. Mass grave number 14 should contain the remains of at least 281 buried individuals. But they weren't just political prisoners. Far from it. These were social graves, where people without relatives were buried, stillborn babies, people whose bodies had been dissected at the Anatomy Institute, and even amputated body parts.
If this initial exhumation is a success, more could follow. And it's not just communist-era political prisoners who are buried here. Some researchers believe Diablice is where the Gestapo dumped the decapitated bodies of the Czechoslovak paratroopers behind Operation Anthropoid, the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, the acting Nazi Reichsprotector of Bohemia and Moravia in 1942. But they can't be sure, and there's only one way to find out. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Just a quick reminder of our feedback address, insideeurope@dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Bien des pyjamas à Grinch et un Nintendo et au cœur un chapeau de Noël.
That's the sound of my daughter Zoe writing her Christmas list, doing it in French, because in France, the post office provides help to kids writing to Santa. It's just one of the many extras that the post office is hoping might help revive the ancient institution's festive fortunes in the age of Amazon and US tariffs. Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris, one of the first European cities to launch an urban postal service nearly 400 years ago.
Actor Jacques Tati plays a bumbling mailman in the 1949 movie Jour de Fête or The Big Festival. He careens across the French countryside by train and bicycle, trying unsuccessfully to match cutting-edge American postal deliveries. The movie cemented Tati's career and today's memories of rural France.
The bicycle is very present in the mentalities, the imaginary of French people, because the bicycle and the mailman, this is Jacques Tati, the representation of the mailman in France in the 20th century.
Sébastien Richez is the historian of the Postal Museum in Paris, one of the few of its kind in the world. Its exhibit includes excerpts of the Tati movie and the kind of old postal bicycle he used. The museum also has a trove of French postal stamps. The first was created in the middle of the 19th century. Before that, recipients, not senders, had to pay for their mail.
You have to pay in the proportion of the distance and the weight. So that was, for almost all the people, impossible to exchange letters because that was too expensive.
The first postal systems began thousands of years ago in ancient Egypt and later on China. The Roman Empire dispatched important officials along with messages throughout its territories, including in Gaul, covering what is today's France. Later, French monarchs had their royal deliveries. In 1653, under Louis XIV, the so-called Petit Poste de Paris was born. The French capital became one of Europe's first to have its own intra-city postal service, so friends, families, and lovers could keep in touch. It only lasted a few months.
Because of the misunderstanding of the people in front of the letterbox. What is the utility of this kind of object?
It took a century before Paris saw another more successful Petit Poste, but a bigger transformation came after the French Revolution.
In France, before the French Revolution, postal system and postal organization is a goal of monarchy and control of the information, the spirit and the mind of the population. After the French Revolution, there is a change. A post is close to the Republic to form the citizen spirit.
In the 19th century, postal services became available in the countryside, even though many people still couldn't read or write. Later, trains, steamboats, and postal codes sped up deliveries. The French mailbox also went through a series of color transformations from green and various shades of blue to today's yellow box that emerged in the 1960s. Historian Richez has a theory about it.
So it is easy to see yellow when you are in winter, in the countryside, and you are looking for the letterbox to post your mail. So.
But in the era of instant messaging, these iconic boxes are vanishing. In 2023, the French Post dispatched 6 billion letters, three times fewer than in 2018. This northern Paris post office was pretty empty one recent Saturday morning. Once it would have been packed. One client, Sylvie, says she rarely sends letters, but she still thinks it's too bad the post is diminished. With fewer deliveries, thousands of mailboxes are no longer in service, especially in rural France. Some rural residents are upset about losing a long-standing symbol.
We're asking the post not to take away all the post boxes before speaking to us, because we still have some residents who are writing letters, and post offices have a role to play.
Jean Billard is mayor of the small northern village of Favril. He's also vice president of France's Rural Mayors Association and on the board of the National Postal Observatory. He understands it doesn't make sense to have postmen checking mailboxes that are often empty, but he believes some should remain.
We still have this relationship with the mailman, because historically in France, it was the mailman who passed through the villages 6 days a week. It was a person who especially old people saw every day.
Retiree Jean-Claude Devoix, visiting the Postal Museum one morning, remembers those days.
At
my in-law's house in the countryside, the mailman would eat lunch with us once a week. It was like that. Today, a book of stamps lasts a year and a half. In the past, it would last just 2 weeks.
On en bouffait un tous les 15 jours, à peu près. Voilà.
Historian Richez believes the French Post will survive changing times. Over the years, it's added on services like banking or printing stamps for other countries. And since the 1960s, it's been helping children, like some of these kids visiting the museum one morning, correspond with Santa free of charge. That's won over some young hearts. Richez was won over long ago.
Post is the synonym of network, relationships, financial exchanges, unity of a country. This is the French history. You have other dimension than simply letters or parcels.
Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
That's reminded me, I've not actually written my Christmas cards yet. Better dash. But not before crediting producer Laura Kabelka and sound engineer Jürgen Kuhn. Next week, we'll be handing the show over to Charlie Shield for a deep dive into the magical world of fungi. So, this is it from me for this year. Wherever you are and whatever you celebrate, thank you so much for listening to Inside Europe this year. From DW in Bonn, take care.